I'm also very grateful to have the opportunity of giving a talk here at this wonderful seminar in this beautiful city. And as you already mentioned, this talk will be about subsystem TDDFT for the response properties and spectra of molecular aggregates. And actually, David just made a comment which is very nice for the first slide that I would like to show you, because this is the point of view of a quantum chemist, essentially, on one of the complex aggregates that we saw in one of the earlier talks on Monday, Bacalis Touché. This is a light harvesting complex that occurs in purple bacteria, the light harvesting complex LH2. And as you can see, this is maybe not the best representation from a chemist's point of view, but it is kind of the representation that you have as a quantum chemist when you set up the input for an electronic structure program. What you put in is the position of the nuclei, the nuclear charge numbers that are color-coded here. You put in the total number of electrons, and that essentially defines your electronic Hamiltonian, which would allow you to determine the electronic structure of this molecular aggregate. But as a chemist, you would probably prefer a point of view in which you try to identify some molecular subunits, some structural motifs, functional groups, and then you typically try to identify active parts, and in these light harvesting complexes that are responsible for absorbing light, the active parts are the chlorophyll, or it's bacterial chlorophyll molecules. The red things are carotenoid molecules, which are embedded in the protein matrix, so the protein is something like an environment that has a certain structural function, maybe modulates the properties, but the essential functional part is this one, is the pigment molecules. So, if you would like to study the electronic structure and absorption properties of such an aggregate, maybe a method would be nice that kind of takes into account the structure in terms of subsystems that you have in such a functional aggregate. And typically you will have to deal with two different types of molecular aggregates. Sometimes it's very easy to identify an active subsystem, for example a solute molecule in a solvent cage, which then would be the environment. But sometimes, as for example in these light harvesting complexes, you have equivalent subsystems. So in this case, you have to treat all of them essentially on the same footing, whereas here you might want to use something simpler, something less accurate for the environmental effects. And in most cases, it might be possible that you have both, because in the light harvesting complexes, you also have the protein environment, of course. And the method that I'm using for that is the subsystem density functional theory, and because I'm not sure if everybody is familiar with the subsystem density functional theory, let me briefly introduce it by comparing it to Cohn-Chem DFT. Well, in Cohn-Chem DFT, we have an energy expression that is typically decomposed into several contributions. We have the electron-nucleus interaction energy and the electron-electron Coulomb interaction that we can essentially calculate exactly if we have the electron density at hand. We have an exchange correlation energy, and also that can, at least to a good approximation, be calculated with standard functionals depending on the density. But the problem in the early days of density functional theory was, of course, the kinetic energy. Because if you would like to calculate the kinetic energy as a function of the electron density, then you have a problem. You have functionals like Thomas Fermi, that was the first one, of course, but most of you will know that is not able to predict binding in molecules, so that's certainly not a good idea to use it here for this large energy contribution. And what Cohn and Chem did was that they took essentially this idea of a non-interacting reference system that has the same electron density, meaning that you can get the electron density as a sum of squares of orbitals of the system and calculate the kinetic energy as a sum of these kinetic energy operator matrix elements involving the molecular orbitals of the system. And if you then minimize this energy expression with respect to the total electron density of the system, you get back the Cohn-Chem equations with this effective potential that is a functional derivative of these three energy terms, and you get the orbitals, the molecular orbitals, the Cohn-Chem orbitals of this total system. And you can imagine that this will be the bottleneck if you have to describe the electronic structure of a very large molecular complex. So the idea of subsystem density functional theory essentially is that you split up the total electron density into subsystem electron densities, each of which is expanded in terms of subsystem orbitals. And then essentially what you can do is you can still calculate the first three energy terms if you calculate the total electron density like that, because they just depend on the density. The problem is in the kinetic energy part, because for that you would need orbitals for the total system. And what people did then is that they came up with the idea that you can actually add and subtract the sum of the kinetic energies of all the subsystems, evaluated from the subsystem orbitals by using an expression like that. And what you see here is that the last two terms now, they represent something like the non-additivity in the kinetic energy of the subsystems, and this non-additivity will be very small and will actually go to zero if the interaction strength is small and goes to zero. So because this is a small part, if you have weakly interacting units, you could actually try to use density-dependent approximations for that. And this goes back to work by Pietro Cortona in 1991, and I have to thank Evert Jan for pointing my attention to an earlier paper by Senatova and Subbaswamy, in which actually this idea is already in. Of course, there are even earlier predecessor methods that, for example, the Gordon Kim model that used an energy expression based on subsystem densities, but here the subsystem densities and the subsystem orbitals are actually calculated self-consistently. How do we get the orbitals? Well, let me illustrate that in a certain special type of this subsystem DFT that we call frozen density embedding. And essentially here, you just use a two-partitioning of the electron density. You say you have an active subsystem that is identified, or that is described by this electron density rho 1, and you have an environment that is described by density rho 2. What you try to do in frozen density embedding is you try to construct an approximation for the environmental density, and you keep it frozen during the calculation. Then you minimize your energy expression with respect to this complementary density to your input density rho 2, and what you get are cone sham-like equations for the subsystem orbitals that have a nuclear attraction contribution from all the nuclei in the system, an electron Coulomb repulsion contribution from the entire electron density, an exchange correlation potential from the entire electron density, and then you have this kinetic energy contribution. So the kinetic energy functions due to this non-additive kinetic energy term give a contribution to the potential. And in this form, it was derived by Wieselowski and Marshall in 1993. And we have actually recently studied the, let's say, the quality of the electron densities that you get out from these types of calculations. And I should mention that, of course, this frozen density embedding can be applied iteratively to all the subsystems in your system, and then you're back at a subsystem DFT. So you derive these equations for all subsystem orbitals, not just for the active one. Okay, what we did was that we looked at a number of molecules with different interaction strengths, starting from rare gas dimers over hydrogen bonded systems. We looked at FHF minus that has a very strong hydrogen bond, and then over to coordination bonded systems, even those with pi back bonding. So this one already has a very strong covalent bonding character. And what we found is that for van der Waals complexes and hydrogen bonds, you get quite good results. Even for this one, starting from asymmetric fragments, you can get a very good and symmetric density representation from the density embedding with simple functionals. And the functionals that we use for this non-additive kinetic energy part are GGA type functionals. In most of the cases, we use a functional that is derived from the Purdue 191 correlation exchange functional. It has the same enhancement factor, but it's a kinetic energy functional. And that is essentially the functional that we use in all the applications that I will show in this talk. Okay, coordination bonds are borderline cases, especially if you have pi back bonding, and for covalent bonds, you get answers that are qualitatively wrong as you would expect. But it is possible actually to reconstruct accurate potentials in a way similar to what Paul Ayers explained on Monday on the reconstruction of potentials by methods like the van Leeuwen-Barents or the Wu and Yang method. And that is something that we did for the ethane molecule here. So what you see here is the ethane molecule split up into subsystems. Subsystem 1 is described as a CH3 plus subsystem or fragment, and the subsystem 2 is a CH3 minus fragment. And we tried to reconstruct the potential that it gives us the correct density of the ethane molecule, and as a reference density, we use the total electron density obtained just from the BP86 calculation. Now the point is you can reconstruct such a potential if you have a reference density for your active subsystem. So we calculated the target density just by subtracting from the total electron density a density for the rho 2 subsystem here, and reconstructed this potential. What you see then here in this plot is the error in the sum of the two subsystem densities that you get. The black curve is just the superposition of the initial fragment densities, and you see that there are fairly large errors here. If you use a standard GGA type functional for the non-additive kinetic energy, then you see that you get this dark blue curve, which is not much better. If you then switch iteratively between the subsystems, actually things get worse, that the light blue curve, but with a reconstructed potential, you get a very nice representation of the density. It's not perfect, and the reason it's not perfect is that the target density rho 1 exact is not strictly BS representable. Okay, but actually I want to go to response properties and excited states. So we have to look at linear response time-dependent density functional theory, in which we want to describe the change in the electron density upon a perturbation. So what we do is we evaluate the change of the density at one point with respect to the change in the effective potential at another point, multiply with this change in the effective potential, integrate all over space. And this first functional derivative is, of course, the response function of the system. You neglect the frequency dependence because in practice we're always working with the ALDA approximation in the ADF program, which I used essentially for all calculations that I've shown. Okay, the problem is a bit in this effective potential because that consists of an external perturbation part and an induced perturbation part, because a change in the electron density will of course lead to a change in the electron-electron interaction potential, and in TDFT, in the response part, this is then evaluated as a linear response also. So we look at the change in the effective potential with respect to a change in the density, multiply with the change in the density, and integrate over R3. And this shows a bit the type of problem that we have in PDDFT. The change in the density depends on the change in the density, and we have to find a way to solve that. Typically, you can formulate this in terms of a matrix eigenvalue problem, as was, for example, for the, in the DMFT case shown in Ivan-Jahn's talk. And the functional derivative that we have here of the effective potential with respect to the density is what we call the response kernel F. Okay, in the frozen density embedding case, you can derive very similar equations. So also there you have this response function, you have the external perturbation, and you have an effective kernel now. And this effective kernel, as it was derived in a paper by Casila and Wisolowski, that is essentially depending also on the entire response of your environmental system. So it is a response kernel that should depend on phi of system 2. In that way, it has never been used and never been implemented. What has been used shortly after this paper appeared is an approximation for localized excitations, which I call uncoupled frozen density embedding, because it neglects the coupling between the response of the active system rho 1 and the environment rho 2, or any other system that we have. So if you argue that you have a localized excitation, then this intra-subsystem kernel just has a Coulomb contribution, an exchange correlation contribution, and it also contains a contribution due to the non-additive kinetic energy part of the potential. This approximation for local excitations works often quite nicely for solvent effects, for example, if you have polar solvents, but as soon as you have delocalization effects, which will typically appear in systems of coupled chromophores, this does no longer work, and therefore I rederived essentially this formalism and generalized it to many subsystems. So also the total electron density change is now split up into subsystem contributions. And then if you look at the density change for subsystem 1, you can actually write it in this way. You still have this intra-subsystem response kernel, but you have to add the change in the potential due to changes in the electron densities of the other subsystems, and then you have an inter-subsystem response kernel that looks very similar, but there's a slight difference. So that means that the general solution of this problem requires also to incorporate response couplings between the electron density change in one subsystem and in the other subsystems. And for excitation energies, what you can do to approximately solve this is that you first use this uncoupled frozen density embedding approximation, calculate the local excited states of all the subsystems, and then you formulate the eigenvalue problem in terms of these local excitations, but you restrict yourself to only the low-lying ones, which are important for the spectrum, and then you can couple them. So you essentially are solving a truncated eigenvalue problem in the basis of the local excitations. The resulting expression in the coupling matrix that you have there looks a little bit like this. So you have this inter-subsystem response kernel that couples transition densities between the different subsystems. And so you essentially have a coupling between transition densities of local excitations located in subsystems A and B. And the diagonal elements of this matrix are the squares of the local excitation energies of the molecules calculated within this FDEU approximation. What you should note is that this is actually a quantity that is of interest in model theories of energy transfer, kinetics, and dynamics. For example, in the first theory, the rate of energy transfer is proportional to the square of such matrix elements, which essentially in a static picture describe the splitting between excited states. There is a related time-dependent DFT approach that is perturbative, starting from isolated monomers, and that is actually from 2001 from the Ed Gordon group, and later on it was generalized by the group of Benedetta Minucci and Jacopo Tomasi in Pisa. And I would like to show you on the next slide how that works in practice for a very simple example, if you use the frozen density embedding approach. This is a system of two Betz-aldehyde molecules. They both have the same structure, just the optimized monomer. And if you calculate the excitation energies in this range, you see you have three excitations. They are all the same for both monomers because they have the same structure. If you then do an uncoupled frozen density embedding calculation, you see that the excited states split because the two monomers see a different environment because of the head-to-tail arrangement. So there's a splitting. They all shift in the same direction, but the amount of the shift is different for the two subsystems that you measure. If you then switch on the coupling, the response coupling between the two subsystems, you see that the lower lying states here essentially remain unchanged, but the higher lying one here, that shows an additional splitting. And if you compare that to a reference calculation, a dimer calculation, then you see that essentially the frozen density embedding calculation reproduces the splitting among the low lying states and among the higher lying states very nicely. If you compare that to an approach where you just couple the transition densities of the isolated molecules, you would not, of course, observe this splitting here among the lower lying states, and here you would get splitting, which is a bit too small, and the vertical position of this of these states is, of course, also bigger. Now, this is a nice technical example, but what you can actually do with this is you can apply it to very large molecular systems. So this is an example, again, from this Lighthouse-Deen complex. It's the so-called B850 subunit of the total Lighthouse-Deen complex, in which you have 18 bacterial chlorophyll molecules. They have two different conformations. There's an alpha and a beta one. And you can calculate the excitation energies of these two conformations in this complex. They are a little bit different. And then you can start switching on the coupling. And you see that they actually split, and the high intensity peak shifts to the red part of the spectrum. There's a lower intensity peak here in the shifting to the blue. You can also do the entire calculation for the entire system of about 2,500 atoms. Then you see that the more intense peak shifts further to the red. And by the way, the intensities here are divided by the number of chromophores. So this one is much more intense, actually. Maybe one more word on this system here. The name B850 actually comes from the absorption maximum that is observed in the experiment. We do not quite measure that here. This is at 812 nanometers. But the coupling seems to be in quite nice agreement with the experiment, which we found out by comparison with this study. So essentially, the reason that we do not hit the absorption maximum from experiment is in these local site energies here, which are a little bit off. But I mean, these errors are, let's say, way below the accuracy that you can expect from TDDFT, of course. Okay, I would like to mention another example that is more recent. We just studied that is the spectroscopy of the astaxanthin molecule, that is a carotenoid-like molecule that occurs in certain proteins. And in free solution, it has an absorption maximum of about 475 nanometers, which shifts in this protein that is called beta-crystacyanine to about 580 nanometers. And it further shifts in another protein called alpha-crystacyanine, the structure of which has not completely been solved, which is an octamer of this dimeric protein. So in this protein, we already have two of the molecules. And in alpha-crystacyanine, the maximum shifts further to the red part. Well, this shift is a shift of, even from free solution to beta-crystacyanine, of about 0.5 electron volts. And it looks quite spectacular if you see it in nature, because in free form it looks like this, like in the lobster Amarus gamarus after boiling it, so that it has a red color. And in the protein, before cooking, it has this dark blue or almost black color. And there are a number of mechanisms that have been discussed for this color change. And yeah, well, you have to explain a change of about 0.5 eV. One thing that has been discussed essentially in these two papers by von Weick et al. In 2005 and then in a more recent paper by Strunge and Durbe is a conformational change from the protein to free solution, but that can only explain about 0.1 electron volts. Excitonic coupling effects have been looked at in both of these papers, and I will come back to that on the next slide. Essentially, in this paper, a dipole approximation was used as in the original first theory. And then it was estimated to be about 0.5 electron volts in this later paper. Essentially, supermolecular or dimer calculation on the astaxanthin dimer has been done, and the splitting has been estimated to be one order of magnitude smaller. the polarization effect by the protein has been estimated in the first paper to be about 0.07 electron volt, in the second one to be about 0.55 electron volt. The difference is that in the second paper, a protonation of a histidine residue has been assumed, which is actually quite unlikely in the view of NMR results that have been published in this paper. Okay, the first thing that I did was to try to reproduce the result from this paper, which I actually could do essentially perfectly. First of all, in the supermolecular calculation, and then I tried whether the supermolecular calculation could be reproduced by flow density embedding. What you see here is that you have two peaks that essentially come from a splitting of two intense peaks of the monomer. So you have a splitting here, and if you evaluate that on an energy scale in electron volts, then you see that it's reproduced exactly what Stumpy and Durbin had suggested, so a very small exciton coupling effect. There's another state that shows a smaller splitting here and is less intense, so that's not so important. It shows that this dipole approximation used in the first paper essentially does not work here. But what is also interesting, and apparently has not been looked at in both of the papers, is that, well, this shift shifts the more intense peak not to the red part of the spectrum, but to the blue part. So the excitonic coupling is not only small, it's also in the wrong direction. Well, is this in agreement with experiment? That is something that you can more easily judge by looking at the circular dichroism spectrum, because there, excitonic couplings lead to this coupling effect. You have one positive and one negative peak, and that is actually something that you can compare to the experimental circular dichroism spectrum. You see that also here you have first a negative peak and then a positive peak in the circular dichroism spectrum. And, well, it's a little bit difficult to estimate how large the excitonic coupling here is, because this band may be an overlap of several bands, but you can estimate that it should be around 0.2 or 0.3 electron volt, so smaller than predicted from the dipole-dipole coupling, but larger than predicted from the supermolecular calculation in the paper by Strumby and Durbin. So one question was, are there other reasons that could be responsible for this underestimation? One drawback of the calculation by Strumby and Durbin was a rather small basis, and that is actually a big advantage of these subsystem calculations. Making the basis larger is essentially no problem. You can easily go to quadruple zeta with four sets of polarization functions. In the calculation on this diagram, you see the energy splitting, or the excitonic coupling, goes up a bit. And you can also easily look at structural effects, because it's not clear how good the quality is of the crystal structure. And you see that in the arrangement that this dimer has in the protein, if you change the angle between the two monomers, then you actually can induce a fairly large change in the excitation energies, in the excitonic splitting. One thing that I would also like to mention still is that we have also looked at the effect of the protein binding pocket. And we found that it is smaller than 0.1 electron volt, taking into account essentially all the residues in the binding pocket of these two monomers. Okay, one last thing that I would like to mention is that we have recently started looking at solvent screening on excitonic couplings. And that is something that we have investigated for this carolinediamine dimer that was also mentioned in the talk by Carlos on Monday already, and that's actually a collaboration that we did with him and with Benedetta Minucci in Pisa. So what we did here is we tried to investigate how the splitting energy between the pi-pi star transitions in these two monomer molecules changes if you put in an environment. And we did that for a distance, for a dimer, separated by a distance of 7 angstrom, solvated by water molecules, and we investigated the splitting as a function of the radius of the solvation shell. This is a little bit difficult actually in this coupled frozen density embedding, because if you want to evaluate the response of the environment, then you're doing that essentially in a sum over states fashion. So you have to couple to a number of excited states of the solvent molecules, and we try to simplify that a bit by introducing a threshold for the contribution of the excited states of the environment to the sum over states polarizability. So we only take those states into account that are really important for the sum over states polarizability. And then you can actually handle fairly large systems also with this coupled flow density embedding. What you see here are the results of this classical model that Carlos already introduced on Monday. So you see that with increasing size of the solvation shell, the splitting between the pi-pi star transitions goes down. If you would do a calculation with frozen energy embedding where you neglect the environmental response, you'd see that the splitting is more or less constant. It's not entirely constant, and the reason that it's not entirely constant is that the transition densities are of course affected by the environment as well. But if you include the environmental response, then you see that you essentially reproduce the behavior from this polarizable QMMM model very nicely in the region from, let's say, 10 or 11 angstrom cutoffs on. So in this area, the two curves run more or less parallel. But what you also see is that the difference between the couplings predicted by the two different methods is actually smaller here if you go to smaller radii, which tells you that maybe the discrete representation of the charges in the classical model is not so good at smaller radii as you would have probably expected. In frozen energy embedding, you have the at least the electrostatic part of the potential essentially represented exactly. Okay, with this I arrive at the conclusions, and I hope that I could show you that subsystem DFT or subsystem TD-DFT is a consistent embedding method for, on the level of energies, the potential, but also on the level of the response. It is a parameter-free quantum chemical approach in the sense of system-specific parameters, of course, the parameterization in the functionals. What you can get out are site energies and excitonic couplings for aggregates of pigments, so you have a diabetic or a quasi-diabetic and an adiabatic picture of the system, and in a sense you can thus bridge the gap between model theories of energy transfer and, let's say, the quantum chemical point of view TD-DFT. What I did not mention is that response properties like polarizabilities or optical rotation can also be computed, and they are actually implemented in ADF. And these response properties can then be analyzed in terms of subsystem contributions, which I think is an advantage in terms of interpretation of the properties that you get out. Here's a review in which these things are explained in a bit more detail. Finally, I would like to thank my group and all the people with whom I've worked in the past on different aspects of frozen energy embedding, the funding organizations, and you for your kind attention.
Thank you, that was very interesting indeed. We now have a few minutes for questions. Then I can start while other people thinking. This looks very good. What are the biggest drawbacks and what kind of things do they miss when we divide it up into subsystems?
Well, what are the drawbacks? I mean, one thing that is clear is that because you're using TD-DFT here, you have all the problems that TD-DFT has for certain types of excitations, and you have to be aware of them. And for example, for the Aztec-Santi, and for these carotenoid molecules, it's known that double excitations can play a role, so you don't get rid of that, that's clear. But for the subsystem approach as itself, one problem is, of course, that if you have a big charge transfer between subsystems, then that is something that makes problems. And you have to work very hard to get that correct, but that's something that we are now able to analyze with these reconstructed potentials, because they actually need charge transfer in order to get the, let's say, the density distribution correct for the entire molecule. So that is probably the biggest problem.
Okay. Other questions?
Okay. My question is about maybe foundations of this density embedding scheme. Can you guarantee in this approach that interactions, physical nature of interactions between embedded subsystem and embedded environment are correctly reproduced in everywhere positive densities? I suppose the densities are everywhere positive, right?
Yes, because we represent every subsystem densities in terms of squares of orbitals, they are positive everywhere. That's
right.
Clear.
And the reason I'm wondering is, well, if we take one more textbook example, 2 helium atoms, of course, then there will be a depletion of the density in the in between the two atoms, right?
Yes.
And compared to the superposition of atomic densities. How can this be described in terms of everywhere positive densities, this effect? So you keep densities everywhere positive, then you get wrong density between two subsystems, two fragments, or you need to make one of the densities negative at some region in space to be able to describe the nature of interaction correctly.
No. I mean, in the most simple approach, where you say you fix one subsystem density and you just optimize the other, I mean, you will never have a negative subsystem density. It's technically impossible because of this orbital approach. But if you have, let's say, one subsystem density that is already larger than the exact density that you want to reproduce, then there is no way to get that in the simple frozen density embedding approach. But if you do this iterative scheme in which you freeze and thaw the densities of all the subsystems, then they are all allowed to change. So they could all become smaller. So there's actually no big problem in reducing electron densities in the intermolecular region.
All right, thank you.
More questions? Let's end this theory.